It's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Don Miller. Don's joining us from CSU Chico, came down this morning. Don got his BS from the State University of New York, after which he got a master's in biological anthropology at Oxford under Anthony Boyce. His project was titled Health and Work and Workload in Nepalese Villages. Pretty big jump back to entomology, studying these aphids under Wayne Goetz at Berkeley, after which he did a NIH-funded postdoc at the University of Arizona, had an assistant professorship at Trinity University in Texas, and then moved to CSU Chico.
Thank you so much for having me. Thanks for coming. Hope everybody can hear me. And if you can't, please let me know. It is a pleasure to come back. I guess I was here about 7 years ago, which is a little while. That doesn't date me, then perhaps showing Red Skelton dressed up as Freddy the Freeletter, that might date me instead, or some of you. I do want to talk, though, about various aspects of a system. I think an interesting system of insects, taking advantage of other insects, and also insects generally taking advantage of plants in terms of getting something for nothing or freeloading, and then this very delicate business of inducing galls where plants otherwise wouldn't provide resources, and finish with a look at a recent student's work on sex allocation, especially adaptive sex allocation. So this photograph captures some of this bestiary, this drama that's hidden within those little folds on the leaves of those new unfolding leaves of manzanitas are plant galls, or if you like, controlled neoplasms, tumors, which otherwise wouldn't be there, but for the fact that there are insects inside now, those leaves probing and irritating the plant, so it actually grows around them and envelops them, and there's a kind of microcosmos, a Horton Hears a Who mini drama that takes place. I've been pursuing this for a good 15 years now. This can be displayed in an ecological sense. There's been some interest recently in looking at non-trophic interactions, in looking at community food webs, and cast this way, we can think of, in this particular group of galling aphids, tamale aphids, we have the gall inducers themselves, they're the ones that actually cause the gall to grow on the plant, and then the incolines, which would be the freeloaders, tagalongs here, and of course the host plants, trophically situated below these two, and the solid lines with arrows denote a trophic kind of interaction. So if it's positive, that means the host plant is feeding the gall inducer. Negative, the host plant is losing by having food drawn from it by the gall inducer. And the incolines, who exist inside these galls as well, also exert the same kind of direct interaction. But between the gall inducers and the incolines, you might think of these as non-trophic interactions because incolines are draining away resources, competing for resources from the gall inducers as well. All right. This seminar now is going to maybe jump around a little bit. Fortunately, I have an audience of people invested in entomology and who are deeply appreciative of complex life cycles and won't even bat an eye if I jump around and move from one morph of aphid to another, I hope. So I'm just going to show you the cast of players a little bit at a time as we go along here. These are two aphids occurring within a gall I dissected, opened up. On the left, Tamalia inquilinus. I named it inquilinus because of what it does. It's an inquiline. It lives alongside, within the very same galls, the gall-inducing species, or set of species, Tamalia coenii, induces. And I didn't position these animals. This is how I found them, just that way. Cozy, snuggly. Tamalia inquilinus, at this point, that's probably a second instar animal there, is delicately built. It's gracile. It looks fairly innocent. And so goes the werewolf. Once they reached full adulthood, inquilinus now looks, well, more like a wolf, I guess. It's very hirsute. It's built a little bit more like a Soviet tank. By that I mean it's heavily sclerotized, especially on top. That's very handy because when they die and shrivel up in the gall, they actually don't shrivel. They look more like little, what are those things called? Spangles. I couldn't think of that word, spangles. Whereas the gall-inducing insect, Tamalia coenii, collapses more like an accordion when it dries up inside these galls, and you're trying to deduce what happened demographically to these calls. All right, so a few words about this group, Tamelia aphids generally. By the way, we're surrounded by them. You might know this or not. That is to say, if you go to the mountains, either the coast ranges, which I think are over here, or the Sierra, which are over there, or transverse ranges, you will find chaparral and manzanitas and closely related plants, and you will find these galls on them. But if you're like most people, you will pay no attention to them. There seems to be a pattern of coast speciation of gall inducers and inquilines, and this, to some extent, seems to be following the lines of diversification of the host plants. And this includes not just manzanitas, but close cousins like madrones and something else called summer holly. As far as I know, all known populations or species occur in groups, occasionally, at least some of the times. So I call that facultative communal behavior. That in itself is unusual in galling insects, galling aphids especially. More often, the gall constitutes a very valuable defensible resource, which is to be protected and defended against intruders or competitors by any means, even to the death if necessary. But laid-back California aphids don't mind if they share gall space together. Are these aphids eusocial? Well, some might argue, and I think Penny Golan and Pete Cranston wouldn't, that eusociality can be defined in part by species having a soldier or a special sterile caste whose purpose it is to defend the colony or clone if you're an aphid. Dimorphic larvae have been discovered and described from various species of aphid, especially in Japan. Now, it looks like Tamelia might be joining these ranks. This is just a shot to show you two, I call them foundresses, females founding or inducing galls, and they're on this summer holly, that's Comorus staphylis diversifolia, out on Santa Cruz Island. Here are these morphs. I think they're interesting, I really do. They're tiny, yes, but on the left is what I call a typical gall inducer morph. And these come not from the first generation of gall inducers, there's more than one, but from a second generation of gall inducers. And they cause galls just as their grandmothers did. So the aphid life history is rather complicated, but in the case of gall-inducing aphids, there's often a series of gall-inducing generations or morphs followed by another generation of dispersing morphs, which possess wings. But the gall-inducers themselves tend to have very reduced appendages and sensory organs, except I'm sure their sense of taste, their gustatory senses are exquisitely well-developed, I'm sure. Now on the right, occasionally, I have found these things I'm calling soldierly morphs. And let's see, where's my, here it is. I think of note are they relatively large tarsi, or claws if you like, functionally, and the long, thick limbs, legs. The overall body size is somewhat larger. The antennae seem to be larger. Maybe most striking when I've seen these things is their behavior is nothing like this. This is more like a little sheep. It sits there and feeds within the gall. Even if you open the gall and disturb it, you'd think. But these soldierly morphs are very nervous animals. They don't seem to sit and feed. They mostly move around at a very high rate of speed. I don't know what they do. But maybe, just maybe, they are patrolling the gall and defending it. Okay? This is highly localized. I've only found this phenomenon in El Dorado County, and only in mid to late summer, even though I've studied Tamelia across the state. So it seems to be very localized, but perhaps it represents what some might call eusociality. There may actually be a soldier caste in this species, and these are very distinctly related from, I think, all the other gall-inducing aphids. You can only extend the analogy so far in terms of the governorship. Well, there you are. I won't drag everyone through this too much. This is a simplified life history diagram. Maybe just point to it. On the inside of these dual concentric circles here, you have life history stages of the gall-inducing species, Tamelia coni, hatching from a sexually produced egg, which most often overwinters, depending on where you are in California. The gall-inducer emerges, and she begins the business of inducing a gall. This may be considered an early phase gall because it's still open. And because it's still open, that means that friends and enemies can show up and invite themselves in. And sometimes they do that. By the trophic phase, she's mature, she begins reproducing, the gall is sealed, and is much more closed to the external world. Later, the gall dries, and if it's well engineered, I guess, it splits open, and it can release the offspring from within. And they seem to come out almost in a single wave. Okay. Now, in both basic clades, lineages, we have the sexual forms, which are very, very similar to each other across these species here. So males appear for the first time in the life history, and I'm calling them here mating females. You could call them sexual females. You could call them ovipary because they produce eggs rather than live young the way the rest of the females do in this series of generations. Okay, closely aligned with all this on the outside circle now, we have inquilines who do seem to just show up uninvited, I suppose, as soon as the earliest galls are out there. They're there. They're just in there. So they can invade then. They generally do not invade trophic phase galls. They can also show up later. And they can still harvest resources available in these shrunken, dried out, mature phase galls, which actually sustain life if you're an inquiline. You can raise a family in there. So two windows of opportunity for inquilines. And again, their sexual forms are very similar to the sexual forms of the gall inducer. And this is the reason I overlooked them as a separate species or species group for a very long time. Okay? Try to remember all that. The wingless morphs or gall inducers, which are some of these things, have various options upon hatching. They can go and found their own gall. That's difficult to do. It's dangerous. You may get eaten. You might get lost. You might find other foundresses which have already started the gall, and you can join them. That appears to be an option. If you're an inquiline, as I just pointed out, you can invade a new gall or a mature one, and no one's going to throw you out. Apparently, there are no agonistic interactions between and among inquilines and gall inducers. I have no evidence for that. No wounds, no battle scars, none of that. I'm calling the aphids causing galls producers. I'm calling inquilines scroungers because they're harvesting resources produced by another entity, namely the gall inducer. They seem to be obligate parasites. If the gall inducers aren't there, inquilines can't do anything. They have to find galls and enter them at the right time of the year. What do they do to the foundresses once they're within these galls? Well, they don't fight them. They don't seem to attack them. They do something else. They appear to outcompete them for resources, as indicated by the difference in the proportion of offspring produced. What I did to get these data was to actually cage these little plant galls and then track carefully the adult offspring actually produced and emerging from these galls. And on average, in these experiments, I found that it was about 9 offspring, not too many, but about 9 offspring produced, whether the galls had foundresses only or whether they shared galls with inquilines, around 9. But when inquilines were there, they took the lion's share. They took the lion's share of production of offspring in those galls. That's statistically significant. Sometimes inquilines occurred in galls only by themselves. They didn't start the galls, I don't believe, but they continued to use them even after they were abandoned. And they can still, you know, produce a few offspring. They can still make do and scrounge late in the season. So they're parasites. They're brood parasites. We have some evidence based on mitochondrial DNA analysis of the history of this behavior. Okay? It appears as though altogether gall inducers and inquilines form a monophyletic group. Within that, inquilines form their own monophyletic group as well. So their ancestors appear to have been gall inducers as well, but then they seem to have lost this ability and have become pure parasites and totally dependent on gall inducers. Okay? And the inquilines are evolving or substituting the rates of mitochondrial DNA much faster than the gall inducers, which raises questions about population structure, what might be going on. My working hypothesis is that inquiline populations tend to be much smaller, more scattered, perhaps go through severe bottlenecks, now and then much more so than gall inducers. Also, inquilines disperse more often on foot. I have evidence for this. So they don't move very far. You can't go very far when you're half a millimeter long. But gall inducers, when the alternate generations, I think universally disperse aerially. So once they get into the air column and act as aerial plankton, they're pretty good at moving. So this is just to throw in, to highlight the relative dispersal strategies of gall inducers and inquilines. I have data from field-based studies. Again, these have implications for how fast and how, in which direction, these clades have been diversifying. In all of these things, you have an alternation between gall inhabiting and then dispersal stages at some point of the life history. With the gall inducers, it appears to be more strictly regulated. They always alternate between a walking stage and then a flying stage. But in inquilines, it looks like it's a mixed bag. Sometimes you'll have a walking stage that begets or bears another walking stage. Other times, that walking stage will bear young, which actually take wing. So it's mixed. And it probably has something to do with the concentration of resources, I suspect. If things are really good where you are, don't leave. Just take a few steps and stay there. That's what I'm thinking. Okay, I warn you, I'd be jumping around a bit with life history stages. This is the egg, which is laid in crevices in the bark, usually at the base of manzanita plants, a very cryptic sort of thing, not easy to find. And this, I'm sorry about this dullness of the shot. That's an early stage gall inducer, and she seems to have managed to start hollowing out a leaf, or rather than hollow it, she's causing it to begin to grow around her. So this would be an early phase gall where she's finding herself. Jumping to another morph, they do have wings. These morphs here have just emerged from this gall. It's early morning, they're drying their wings out. They're gonna crawl up, they're gonna let them dry, and the first puff of wind they'll take to the air. This particular stage, though, is not sexual. This is a dispersing morph. So this would be the first generation of winged aphids emerging from the first generation of galls. If we jump ahead now to the last generation of gall and open it up, you can find the young with wing buds or alatoids. The pale green ones are the males. There's a single ovipara or sexual female. She's that dark green. Then on the right is a gall inducer. So my point here is partly you can actually sex them quite easily. So these are the sexuals. These are the males and the mating females. And going back to the question of sex allocation, this is the stage that my student was studying especially. E.O. Essig had a fondness for aphids, I think it's fair to say. Here's a drawing modified from his own work showing this ovipara or sexual female. Among aphids, it's actually very unusual to have winged ovipari or sexual females. Far more often, they're wingless, and they release pheromones, and this attracts males. The mating system of Tamalia seems to be very unlike just about anything else. I think these little patches here, these are called cribriform plates. This is where sex pheromones would be produced by the female. But the mating system, as far as I know, doesn't suggest that that's particularly important. All right, a little bit of field work here. I'm jumping to this far away, distant place in western Colorado where I was given a tip to go and look for Tamalia, the Uncompahgre Plateau. This is greenleaf manzanita or Arctostaphylos patula in the foreground. And I still haven't confessed to my wife exactly how difficult it was to get her new Prius up this mountain and to this place. And I hope she never finds out. But it actually went up and went down again, and I made it. But what awaited me up there was, well, it was beautiful. It was a thoroughly isolated population of Tamalia, far away from California. It might even be a new, yes, species, and if it is, I'll call it Uncompahgrensis or some other mouthful. The timing was such that I found little tiny groups of males. This is what they do, and again, I think this is a little strange for aphids. Males which are winged, that's not so strange. But in Tamalia, they run around the uppermost leaves of the host plants, manzanitas. You can see one on the left pretty well. Tiny little things, they run around, they take flight. They run all over the leaves. female's approach, ovipary approach. Now it seems to be a kind of scramble. The males are not, they don't do courtship. They just tackle the female. And then I guess one of them manages to mate successfully. So females are winged, and they approach these little groups, and then they find their partners that way. Again, that's more like a swallowtail butterfly than an aphid. Okay? But that has, I think, implications for the nature of sex allocation patterns. So I want you to remember that, if you could. All right. Now I'm jumping back to the early stages of inquilines. This shows some, what's it called, tanglefoot. I wiped, smeared on a petiole of manzanita. I wanted to find out if inquilines did sneak around at night, as I suspected they did, and if I could catch them in the act. And apparently that's exactly what they do. Okay, so that's another aspect of life history I'm going to talk about, it for which I have relatively new data. In terms of exploitation, yes, the insects are exploiting the plants, for sure. Plants get nothing from it. But the inquilines also, on top of that, are exploiting the gall inducers. What can gall inducers do? Well, they induce galls quickly. It's probably good to get yourself inside a gall as fast as you possibly can, if for no other reason to get you away from the elements, the sun and the wind. But the inquilines are going to have to hustle. So their life histories will have to be very closely tuned. And somehow they hatch at the right time and they show up, as I pointed out before. Gall inducers get around pretty well aerially. They can colonize an isolated manzanita in the middle of a ponderosa pine forest. They'll find it. Somehow they get there. They're pretty good at that. So they may be able to stay a few steps ahead of inquilines. On the other hand, inquilines, based on my experimental evidence in the lab, can handle predator pressures better. I did trials with Leucopus larvae, and the maggots absolutely preferred the gall-inducing aphids over the inquilines. They did not like, apparently, the inquilines. They wouldn't eat them. Then when I toasted them, the inquilines lived longer. I only had to do that once, okay? Just once, got my data, I was done with that. So inquilines, which you might reason are more exposed to predators and exposed to desiccation, appear to be better suited for dealing with those threats. Remember, inquilines may be out cruising for galls, and they may be in old, dried-out galls trying to make a living in there. So it seems to make sense. Once the inquilines are in the galls, as I've shown you before, they can outcompete the gall inducers. There seems to be some kind of a negative correlation. No, they can't induce galls, but they can make up for this deficiency by harvesting resources and converting them into offspring, apparently more efficiently than inquilines can do. So I created a couple of different kinds of experiments, which I carried out very recently. And I call this first set exit trials. And from this idea that if inquilines really are cruising around and trying to sneak into galls, okay, I predicted that they'd be more likely to get caught in tanglefoot than would gall inducers. So I simply set up tanglefoot and leaf petioles supporting these gall leaves. I followed them on a weekly basis. After 2 weeks, I collected the whole leaves, the whole thing, took it back to the lab. These are tiny. My eyes are failing increasingly. And I looked at them under the scope to see what was going on. Then I opened up the gall to see what the source might have been. I have some data. Carried out 3 of these trials. In 19 of these, I found inquilines trapped in the sticky stuff. The total number of these inquilines was 82. Gall inducers, there were just 3. Total number of inducers trapped was just 5. So there appears to be a strong correlation with inquilines cruising around and getting stuck, as opposed to gall inducers doing the same thing. Okay. The other point that might be important is that inquilines are only about 1/10 as common as gall inducers. So this is not because inquilines are much commoner, not at all. They're much rarer. The other set of trials I carried out, I called intergall dispersal trials. And basically, I was interested to see if I could find evidence that indeed these animals were leaving a gall for a reason, to find another gall that they could invite themselves into instead of housekeeping. I tried various things. Research is hard. I got a laboratory pipetter and tried to draw up about 100 microliters of this fluffy stuff called animal tracking powder. Some of you may have. It's been used for rodents. It's been used for insects. And then I would go to a goal that had at least an opening on the end, and I would puff it in there, and it was very satisfying when a little puff came out the other end. Then I thought, okay, whatever was in there, I covered it, I think, I hope. All right. I designated those galls the donor galls. All neighboring galls, those within half a meter of walking distance, okay, along these little branches, these crooked branches, I called those host galls. And then I went back, gave them, again, a couple of weeks, and then I went and estimated the distance between donor galls and all the host galls within half a meter of walking distance. I collected these galls, dissected them again, and looked, mostly in vain, for any evidence of aphid movement showing up in these host galls. And oh boy, this is like the Holy Grail. I found an exuvium of an incline. I could tell for sure. That seemed like a smoking gun. Absolutely, an incline went there. It shed its skin, but I got the skin. Remember, inside galls, things are left. There's evidence. There's body parts. There's body waste. There's exuvia. All kinds of things lead up to evidence for what actually happened. So for sure, at least some of the time, they do sneak out and invade other galls. And doing this over enough time gave me a data set. I broke down the distance between these two kinds of gall into five classes, if you will, based on the number of centimeters. I examined this many of each of these classes. All of the galls that had any evidence of dispersal were within 10 centimeters. They were often the nearest neighbor gall, so they really didn't seem to go very far at all. Just next door. Okay? And the mean dispersal distance is a whopping 3 centimeters. That's about the length of a gall. So they basically came out and went to the next gall, if they could possibly do that. So it does seem, based on this evidence, that inquilines are much more likely to sneak around and to perhaps invade other galls. And this is a way of an inquiline female sitting in a gall taking advantage of neighboring galls. She just sends out the little troops and out they go and set up shop elsewhere. They seem to go for the nearest neighbors, which is what a lot of good parasites do, is they stick very close to where the resources are at certain life history stages. And again, this has, I think, real implications for population structure. If these populations are so viscous, and if these aphids much of the time are only moving on foot and only very short distances, it stands to reason that these populations are much more isolated and can change much more rapidly because they're so small. Whereas if they're gall inducers, they're sending aphids far away and they're mixing up. Their gene pools are mixing much of the time far and away. Things are going to be a wash and you will not have the rate of diversification going on that you do in inquiline. So it seems to stand up. All right, on to this part two, looking at the question of adaptive sex allocation. My past student, Colin Purdy, carried out this work. We worked together. I'm going to consider a few different things that are outlined here. Question of equal sex ratios, biased sex ratios, and then this business of conditional sex allocation. Darwin, Fisher, other luminaries thought about why sex ratios appear to be equal, at least in many species, most noticeably the human species, or near equal. And I think it's fair to say Fisher was one of the first to imagine that any sex which was rarer than the other would be automatically favored. Selection would favor the rarer of the sexes. So this we might call negative frequency dependent selection. So you tend to have equilibrium over time. It wouldn't make sense to consistently invest in the sons and daughters and stick with that because things would balance out the other way. In practice, it seems many species, many invertebrates, display biased sex ratios. One version of this has to do with this idea of adaptive sex allocation. If the return on male and female function is not equal across, say, a gradient of resources, for example, then conditional sex allocation might apply. If a phenomenon like local mate competition, which Hamilton nicely articulated in a paper in 1967, if that's going on, it might make sense to bias your sex ratios. Now, I said, don't forget about the little males running around and mixing things up. local competition wouldn't seem to apply because the sexes come together far away from their natal place, and you don't have a few males fertilizing a whole bunch of females in the same place. It does not seem to apply. Neither would local resource competition, where you only need a few females for the same kinds of reasons. It does seem as though condition-dependent sex allocation may be the best way to proceed here. The Trivers-Willard hypothesis formalizes this in a general sense. I've adapted it to this particular system here, where on the x-axis you've got a gradient of resource availability or quality of resources, environmental quality, call it any of those things. And then the fitness payout to the parent or the mother follows. So that if resources are slim, invest in males. A few males get the job done. Okay? At some point, it's about 50-50. If resources are many and plenty, then good daughters are really worth a great deal in terms of fitness payoffs. Invest in daughters. Okay? This is an application of the Trivers-Willard hypothesis. All right. To reiterate some of these aspects of Tamalian life history, I pointed out that only the last generation is sexual, so you can focus on that one. Presumably, the investment decisions about sex allocation are made by the last season of gall inducers in some fashion. As I tried to convince you, it's not too hard sexing these juveniles in the gall, thank goodness. And if you think in terms of a clone, a lot of this is basically clonal biology. Tamalia act as simultaneous hermaphrodites. That means you don't have effects of early male mortality skewing the sex ratio one way or the other. Nope. They seem to come out at about the same time. So differential mortality of the sexes shouldn't be accounting for a bias in sex ratio. So I'm trying to rule out these other hypotheses, you see. Had evidence from earlier work I'd done with my postdoc advisor, Leticia Velez, that, scattered. These large broods are more and more female biased. The larger the brood, the more likely it is it will be female biased. But look at the scatter. Look at the scatter. It's all over the place. You have unisex broods here. You have unisex broods there. The triangles denote little broods, right, which for spurious reasons might lead you to believe there's a huge sex ratio skew. They're just little. The squares denote broods in which asexual forms were present. It's messy when you deal with aphids. All kinds of things going on. But I want you to note the scatter because it's so huge. Our R-squared value is it's small. But it's a significant trend. More resources would suggest a larger brood size and would suggest that females should bias their broods towards daughters. And that's what they seem to do. Leticia ran out some simulations, some bootstrapping, to try to randomize based on the data set we had and generate a probability distribution, okay, to get an expected number of various kinds of broods. Okay? So just the sheer number of unisex broods based on, 1,000 replicates was this generation. But the observed number was well beyond that, and statistically significantly so. And the same thing goes for all female broods. That's off the chart, way beyond this probability distribution. Highly, highly unlikely. Okay? Similar pattern applies to the largest unisex broods for both all male and all female broods. All of this suggests the aphids are actively manipulating the sex ratios. They're doing it. So we had that information at hand, and the question that I asked with my student Colin was, can you manipulate this? This other stuff is just out there. We observed it. Could you possibly manipulate this and see if the aphids respond accordingly? So for this study, which took place in Butte County near Chico, he went out and fertilized the plants with urea. He had a low treatment, 25 grams in 2 liters, a high, and then a control, water, okay? Fertilized the manzanita plants. Used a randomized block design. Later went back, collected galls, and recorded proportions of males and females of the offspring within these galls, the brood size, dried and weighed them to try to get a sense of investment one way or the other in that sense. And also look carefully at the ovipary to get a sense of how many eggs they may have laid. And did quite a bit of work. And these are the results. I'm working through this right now. It looks as though in the control, we had significantly more males produced in these broods than when the manzanitas were enriched by means of adding urea. This is highly significant. I was actually rather surprised to see this. It seemed to work. Wow. You give them food and they go for more females. Relative brood size wasn't so nice and neat. Yes, the controls seemed to have fewer offspring than the high treatments, but none of this actually was statistically detectable. There's a huge amount of variation noise. That's probably what's going on. So we really can't draw safe conclusions here. But this is a fairly simple sort of thing. The body weight of any of these treatments of male versus any of these treatments of female was vastly different on average. Okay? So they're investing much more in the daughters than in the males. So it looks like not only are they investing more numbers of daughters, they're also bigger. So that's an even greater degree of sex allocation towards the female fitness unit. Okay? What about the number of eggs? Maybe they respond by developing more eggs within. Same thing. There was no way of detecting any statistical difference in terms of these treatments, in terms of the number of ova, presumptive ova, within the daughter's bodies that Colin dissected. So they don't seem to be doing it that way. This was disappointing. The assay Colin used to measure how much nitrogen was actually in these leaves, it was called a Dumas, some of you might know this, and just really couldn't draw a clear difference. So it didn't seem as though the plants were reflecting these fertilizer treatments. I would imagine there are a lot of other things going on. There may be free amino acids the aphids are responding to in the phloem. It's hard to say. I imagine this may just have been too blunt a tool, but I would welcome feedback on that. I should say a few words about my recently completed sabbatical. My first one, I hope not my last. I did it this fall. Among other things, I collected Timaleon on Santa Cruz Island. That's Santa Cruz Island in the background. If you ever have a chance, go there. Wow, it's wonderful. And then I had a chance to travel to Vanderbilt University in Nashville, worked with a colleague, Patrick Abbott, and we carried out some projects, got them started. One of them called massively parallel pyro sequencing. I guess you know about this stuff. I guess this is in vogue now. But it's using a fairly high-powered tool to try to get a whole genome. Okay, what is out there now that wasn't there so recently was a completed genome of apisum, acerthosiphonpisum, the pea aphid. And that could be a reference tool for looking for patterns of gene expression. What I'm most interested in, first off, is trying to find gene expression for gall induction or the loss of gall induction between gall inducers and inclines, because I suspect there's some kind of gene expression difference that's going on there. Learned how to do some cDNA synthesis to look for possible different levels of expression in individual animals. Learned how to culture fungal associates. Now, these galls are menageries, bestiaries. Various organisms are in there, including fungi, and I'm beginning to think fungi really matter. I have found galls with live aphids entrapped in the hyphae. You open up the gall, and it's full of hyphae. Aphid can't move. Okay, it's like Gulliver. Is it Gulliver and all the little Lilliputians? They're holding them down. Yeah, I think they probably matter. There may be some very interesting ecology going on. So we're just trying to figure out what they are, these fungi. And last, I really want to chase down this phylogeny and get better, more detailed, more solid evidence on the pattern of the history, the origins of gall induction on these plants, their co-diversification with the plants, and then the origin of inquilines, and then their diversification layered on top of that. Thank you.
Since the gall-inducing aphids reproduce so much better when they're by themselves than the inquiline aphids do when they're by themselves, in a population that is heavily infected by equines, do you ever see some evidence that some gall-inducing aphids as a defense are not inducing galls?
No. So if they didn't induce galls, so are you saying that alternatively they're joiners and they're joining other?
Well, they could.
They have to be in a gall.
They have to be in a gall.
Oh, yeah, maybe I didn't make that clear. Sine qua non. If they're not in a gall,
okay.
They basically dry out. I mean, they're gone. And even the aerial forms, I've worked with these things. I've learned a little aphid husbandry, just a little. You can actually contain the aerial forms that give rise to live gall inducers in little cages over the host plant. We're talking about hours or days, and they're just gone. I think these little animals, when you cut them off from food supply, they dry out really fast in the California sun. So you have to be in a gall. Yeah. Okay.
So I've read some papers about pemphigus, I guess.
What are they?
Pemphigus.
Oh, those, yes.
So how are they similar to Tamalia in their behavior?
It appears as though there have been at least 17 origins of this soldier or sterile soldier cat. Maybe you can say now there's 18. There are a lot of interesting parallels that have arisen apparently completely independently. Now, I don't have a phylogeny for you, but I understand that Tamalia is a far-flung little twig way out there, and then the pemphigines, pemphigus, then they're much closer to Areosomatids and other much better known gall inducers. But the parallels are such that it's the same sort of thing. You have alternation between gall-inducing morphs and then aerial dispersers. Pemphigus galls tend to be bigger. When they're long-lived, you may have hundreds, thousands, tens, or hundreds of thousands of aphids living in this thing. And I think when Aoki, one of the early Japanese workers, discovered these things, he noticed when you handle a gall, your hand would cover with bites. So little soldiers would swarm out, and then they start biting, really biting. So it seems as though this business of a defensive cast is correlated with longevity in the gall and the sheer size of the resource. The longer live the gall, the bigger it is, the more about it, the more likely you are to see soldiers. And remember that if you have a single clone in there, your relatedness is one. Right? You don't want to fight with yourself. I mean, you can argue with yourself, but so essentially, the animals are acting as a single evolutionary unit. And you'd think that you couldn't have higher relatedness giving rise to higher levels of sophistication of defensive behaviors. So there's some really strong parallels, I think, there. And I find it exciting because Tamalia is a whole new arena. And it's doing some weird things on its own that pemphigus isn't doing.
Does pemphigus have
ankle lines? Yeah. There may be some, I forget the name, but there's a nasty Japanese one that actually moves into galls and then kills or usurps the owner, if you can call her that. So it's not nice. It doesn't just stay there. It actually gets rid of her, disposes of her, and then takes over the gall. The slave-making ants, you know, there are various other, many, many analogies across the insect world. So that does happen. They do have inclines. I don't even know if you have these cozy relationships or these non-fighting, right, non-combative relationships going on as much. I learned something. I had to keep repeating what I saw until people started believing me that these aphids, in fact, did live alongside each other and they didn't seem to fight, because I was told quickly as a grad student, you're wrong.
Do you think
of course they fight.
Chemistry involved in that, being able to live together and not be attacked?
So in other words, are you saying that the inclines maybe have some sort of a cloak, they're disguised? That's a great question. Hydrocarbon chemistry may involve, yeah. That's a wonderful question. We'll have to find out. Yeah. Did you have that?
Yeah, I'm kind of intrigued by the results that the inclines do a lot better, produce a lot more offspring when they're with the gall maker. And do you have any sense of whether the gall maker needs to, you know, be actively manipulating the host? Can you kill the gall maker? I mean, that difference could be caused by the inclines either selecting, you know, an active gall or a less active gall. But can you get a sense of whether the gall maker is sort of manipulating its host plant in that way.
Yeah, I like that. So it sounds a little bit like the gallmaker is preoccupied with just tending house, you know, keeping the thing going, because the plant would be happy to just shut down. And now you got this incline just goes in and just helps itself. Here's a little bit of evidence. I don't have a photo, but you can see little pricks along basically the crease of the, these are leaf roll galls, and you can see little pricks suggesting that the gall inducer is feeding at various points, not just one spot, but she's moving around. And I imagine she needs to keep doing that. I think if the gall inducer is not provoking the gall, it'll just stop growing or even just shut down. So I think that could in fact be the case. And I think the incline could simply walk in there and just feed. And again, apparently, for whatever reason, it's consuming things fast enough that it pumps out more offspring. Most of the time, the gall inducer doesn't leave. Most of the galls you find, almost all of them have a gall inducer, but those with inclines have a gall inducer as well. The galls that had only inclines, I suspect the gall inducers had basically died or shriveled. I couldn't find them. But they generally don't leave. I've done trials where I put cages over these galls to check the rates of departure. 95% of the time, gall inducers won't leave their gall, for a good reason, I think. You know, they can't do much. But inclines have wanderlust. It's something about, I think it's 30 to 40% of the time, they'll just leave. They'll walk out. They'll go walk about. They'll leave the gall, possibly to find a better gall elsewhere. Does that semi-answer your question?
Yeah, can I ask you another question? I don't know.
I'm happy. I could do this all day.
Do you have any sense that sometimes it's not so simple and the plant can sometimes kill the gall maker? Or does the gall maker just have it, you know, just have it totally figured out?
I think the gall maker is manipulating the plant rather handily. I know in the case of pemphigus, our friends the pemphigus there, I believe Tom Witham has found cases where this, I think he called it premature abscission. Leaves are dropped. Leaves containing galls are more likely to be dropped. Now, in case of manzanita, you look at a plant, you can see this year's growth, last year's growth, the previous, all the leaves seem to stay there. I suppose manzanita invests heavily in each of those leaves, and it's quite a loss if they drop them. I'm not saying that's the reason. But I don't see any evidence of premature leaf abscission by manzanitas as a defense against these, which is not to say they couldn't be sending resources somewhere else. I suspect, I don't have evidence, I suspect the aphids are pretty good at translocating resources. This may be part of the reason why we couldn't detect any difference in the foliar nitrogen, because the aphids are much more sophisticated chemists than we are, I think. Yeah?
So those two soldier, like the soldiery morph and the other morph, that's not like a polyethism, is it? Or are those deterministic casts? And do you think that the defensive cast plays a role in deflecting the inquilines that might invade later? And can you manipulate something like the frequencies of the cast within colonies and see whether there's like adaptive colony demography or something with those two morphs?
I love that this whole system just jazzes me. And I want to get back there, you know, west of Lake Tahoe and chase it down, and it's been sitting there fallow. And maybe I didn't highlight enough that those two animals I showed you were collected from the same mother. So they are really clone mates. And she's actually making decisions within her body. I think your hypothesis is very good, that this soldierly thing is running around and chasing away inquilines, which otherwise might invite themselves into the gall. At this point, I mean, the whole system of manzanitas and these galling aphids is not particularly amenable to a lab. They're fussy plants, they're long-lived. Maybe I'm lazy, but all I've ever done is study them in the field. And then they're tiny, so it is difficult. What was the rest of your question? You had some other interesting.
Oh, I suppose maybe there could be like adaptive colony demography. So if for females that are populations with a lot of inquilines or something, they might shunt at resources in such a way as to skew it to have more soldierly behavioral types or morphs, casts.
Right. Yeah, that's a fascinating idea. And you also mentioned, polyethism.
Yeah.
And I would say that this is fixed, which makes it actually a stronger case, if you like, for eusociality than the cases in which you have monomorphic larvae doing different things. These guys are, I can show you them again, there's no going back. If you're born a soldierly morph, it seems like you remain a soldierly morph, and maybe you can help me figure out exactly what they do and we can get a handle, because I think it's pretty exciting. Yeah.
I just want to get the study you talked, you mentioned the difference between the gall formers and the implens with respect to Leucopus and how that would attack one versus the other?
Yeah.
Says, how often is Leucopus involved in this?
Yeah. Might it actually be a potent selective factor? And right. Leucopus, I think it feeds on various foodstuffs, but they're, you might find them in half the, on the right time and place, you might find them in half of these galls. They're just everywhere. And I think they just blow through it if it's left and right. They attach their mouth parts to the outside of a larva, and it deflates like an old balloon. It just collapses. I mean, they're really serious predators. Leucopus and another one called Heringia, which is serpid. And I think pemphigus suffers from the same kinds of predators. They're a menace within these galls. So they actually could be a selective factor, I think. Yeah. Does that answer your question?
Sort of, but what role would they play, do you think?
Oh, the Leucopus?
Yeah.
How might they change the dynamics between...
Well, you mentioned the difference between the two aphids and the gall.
Right.
With the implants being far more... Much tougher, right?
Right.
So is that in response to predation, do you think?
That's my supposition. I mean, they seem to be better able to withstand the attacks of predators. And on an experimental basis, I mean, I just laid it out in little petri dishes in front of my eyes. I watched them carefully. The maggots bumble around their blind, I think, and they bump into things. And when they bumped into a gall inducer, like as not, they would latch on and penetrate with their mouth, their hooks, and begin to deflate the hapless aphid. But it was almost as if the inkline had something on its surface that just caused them to bounce back. So it's almost like they were untouchable. So there was a really strong difference between them. I was surprised at the difference. So I think it could matter. Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks very much.
Thank you for having me. No, no, non-thirds or errors.